It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Glenn Forbes in for Mike McIntyre. Thanks so much for joining us. Ohio Republican lawmakers proposing a number of changes to the newly passed recreational marijuana statute. That law is set to go into effect next week. Akron's Citizens Police Oversight Board will review a police internal investigation that found 8 officers who fatally shot Jaylen Walker last summer were justified in their actions. Youngstown State University getting blowback over its decision to hire Ohio Congressman Bill Johnson as its new president. Cleveland Mayor Justin Bibb weighs in on the shooting after a holiday lighting last week and says police can't do it all. Parents need to step up as well. And Ohio will get a settlement from major companies over a 5-year-old lawsuit involving forever chemicals contaminating the Ohio River. Joining me to talk about all of these and other stories from IdeaStream Public Media, reporter Abigail Botar. Good morning.
Good morning.
Associate producer Josh Boos. Josh, how are you?
Morning, Glenn. Thanks
good
for having
to see
me.
You. In Columbus, State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kessler. Karen, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
We don't take calls on the Friday Roundtable, but you can send us your thoughts on any of our topics or anything on your mind. Why not? At soi@ideastream.org. I suppose that's a little dangerous to invite that. Or find us on X, formerly Twitter, at Sound of Ideas. Let's get ready to roundtable, folks. Ohio's new recreational marijuana statute goes into effect next week, December 7th. Voters approved the legalized use for adults 21 and older when they passed issue 2 last month. Before it goes into effect, Republican lawmakers working to tweak that law, they can make those changes because it is a statute and not an amendment. Karen, State Rep. Gary Click of Vickery has proposed House Bill 341. There's some home rule type provisions in there that would allow local governments to prohibit the use and cultivation of marijuana or limit it. It also changes the tax revenue distribution. What can you tell us?
Well, I think it's really interesting to look at the component of that that deals with local communities being able to ban marijuana, because this kind of goes against what we've seen in state lawmakers' actions in the last couple of, well, really years, because they've banned local communities from banning plastic bags. They've banned local communities from banning flavored vapes, which they're now trying to override Governor Mike DeWine's veto of that. And it's just kind of interesting that they're going to let local communities ban marijuana in this proposal. Though, I have to say, this proposal and another one from Representative Cindy Abrams from the Cincinnati area, both Click and Abrams are Republicans, they are in the House, whereas the Senate had said that they wanted to be the chamber that started all the changes that could be coming for issue 2. So these bills have been proposed. They're out there. I don't know if they're going to be able to move or not.
And what about that tax distribution piece to it? I mean, it looked like, you know, there was some shuffling around there, different programs this was going to go to. What's in that proposal?
I think there's been a desire to change the way that the tax structure has gone. When voters approved issue 2, they approved language that said that about 3/4 of the tax revenue that would be coming from the sale of marijuana would go to either the social equity and jobs fund that this bill sets up, this law sets up, or they would go to local communities that have dispensaries. And then the rest of the money, about 25% would go to administrative costs and also addiction treatment. But there's been a desire to really change that around. And in fact, there's a bill, or the Chamber of Commerce, rather, had suggested that it should be divided equally among the state and the local government fund, and then also the One Ohio Recovery Foundation, which is the private nonprofit organization that's currently dealing with about half of Ohio's settlement from the national opioid lawsuits. So there's real struggle back and forth over who's going to get the money that this is going to generate. And I would expect to see some changes when it comes to tax revenue and where it goes.
Have we heard from the backers of issue 2, the coalition to regulate marijuana like alcohol? You know, were they expecting some of these tweaks? Were they expecting some pushback here?
Well, they were expecting changes, definitely. They were expecting, and when I talked to the group, it's called the Coalition to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol, their spokesperson, Tom Herron, he said that, you know, one of the reasons that this was a law on the ballot in November and not a constitutional amendment was because there could be changes, because the marijuana industry is going to change, and he expected some changes from state lawmakers. Don't know exactly how they're looking at these proposed changes, And what we're really waiting for is something that will move forward next week. The law takes effect on Thursday. And a lot of lawmakers, including Governor Mike DeWine, have said they don't want the law to take effect and then for lawmakers to come in and tinker with it. Because once you put it out there and then you take some things away from it, that's going to confuse voters. It's going to be frustrating for people who voted for this. But the Senate spokesperson, John Fortney, Senate Republican spokesperson, John Fortney, told me that there's no plan right now to repeal the law created by Issue 2. There's no plan to pull it all the way back, though there was a video that circulated last night on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it, that supposedly was from a webinar with the Ohio Manufacturers Association that suggested that all of the language could be pulled back. We're waiting to find out if that's the case, but I according to the Senate Republican spokesperson, that's not going to happen. The law is going to go forward, but it's going to go forward with tweaks and changes.
Yeah, and Karen, we had heard from Governor DeWine shortly after the election that he wanted some provisions in there, kind of limiting the use of marijuana in public, trying to shield kids from that smoke, but also, you know, the advertising, I guess, around edibles or things of that nature. Are those things likely to happen? What's the latest there?
Oh, I think there's some real concern about the use of marijuana in public. And in fact, the Chamber of Commerce, in its letter to state lawmakers asking for certain changes, specifically said that Ohio should do what Colorado has done and ban the use of marijuana in all public places, indoor and outdoor, which would in some ways deal with the problem of smoke and being able to smell it and that kind of stuff, which DeWine talked about. But the chamber wanted to see some changes with the tax structure and also wanted to see some employer protection laws beefed up so that employers who want to do more testing or put in more rules to ensure a drug-free workplace would be able to do so. And I know that the folks who had backed this proposal had said they had no problem with that, that nothing in Issue 2 changed the law when it came to employers. So that's, I think the real timeline question here is what's out there, though. I mean, the law takes effect on Thursday, like I said. And so lawmakers have a lot of work to do in less than a week to try to make changes if they want to do that.
Well, that is certainly the case. And of course, it never ends with the election. It's the aftermath and it's how it is implemented and all those things. We'll continue to keep an eye on that, Karen.
Thanks. And also,
go ahead.
One other thing I want to add here that, you know, the law does take effect on Thursday, but it will take a while to set up the system of regulations of recreational marijuana. And I think that one of the major concerns here with all these changes is how would any of this affect home grow, which is what a lot of people had wanted to see out of this. And will there be efforts to try to ban home grow? And certainly when you look at some of the proposals or listen to people talk about the proposals about THC content, that could potentially affect the home grow aspect of Issue 2. So all of this is stuff that we're watching.
All right, Karen, thanks very much. We certainly appreciate it. On Tuesday, Akron Police released the finding of its own report into the death of Jaylen Walker. He was shot and killed by officers following a car chase in June of 2022. A grand jury decided earlier this year not to indict the 8 officers involved following an investigation by Ohio's Bureau of Criminal Investigation. In his executive summary of the report, Akron Police Chief Steve Milet wrote, "While there were some instances where some of the officers did not follow departmental procedure, the officers were justified in their actions." Abigail Botar, what were these procedures that the officers, you know, did not follow throughout this chase?
Yeah, there were a few things that people had criticized from the police response that Milet addressed in his executive summary of the internal investigation. One was that an officer had added an extension to his department-issued magazine that increased capacity to up to 6 additional rounds. Milet addressed this, saying that the officer thought this action was permissible, and Milet said that the investigation found that there was a lack of clear language in the department policies about this. It's also important to note that the Bureau of Criminal Investigation report found that this added capacity had no impact on the outcome of the shooting. Another thing Milet addressed was 2 potential violations during the car chase that preceded the shooting. 2 cruisers entered the chase without specific authorization from a supervisor, and 2 officers didn't activate their body cameras. Milet wrote that these officers didn't intentionally violate any policy. And the last issue he addressed was that an officer had used his cruiser to close the driver's side door of Walker's vehicle to stop him from exiting, which Milet said was reasonable given the circumstances of the case.
Now, there hasn't been much further comment or any further comment really from the police because of pending litigation. What has some of the other reaction been, either from city leaders? I know Congresswoman Amelia Sykes had a statement. What has some of the reaction been to this report, this internal investigation?
Right. So we heard from Mayor Dan Horrigan, who put out a statement saying that he supports Milette's assessment of the case. And we did hear from Representative Amelia Strong Sykes. Her district covers all of Akron, and she has been pushing for the United States Department of Justice to investigate the patterns and practices of the Akron Police Department. So she said she's going to continue to do that and continue to have conversations to talk about policing in the community to kind of gain trust back. Bobby DiCello, he's the Walker family's lawyer who's pressing this suit against the city and the police department. He released a statement talking about the importance of the lawsuit now against the police department to bring justice for Walker. And then the other thing that we saw this week was the city's Citizens Police Oversight Board, which came to fruition after Walker's death. The board announced that it will review the internal investigation the department did.
And this, of course, I mean, it was a significant moment, really, you know, for this region, and it was a national story, but also it was a significant moment for, you know, community police relations in Akron. The city's going to be getting a new mayor, Shamus Malik, and Chief Milette previously announced he's going to leave the job at the end of the year. He served a little more than 2 years here in Akron. It wasn't that long ago when we were doing stories about his hiring.
Yeah.
So what do you think? I mean, obviously the challenges for Shamus Malik are significant, and this is also a time of transition for the police department.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is going to be a lot, and people in Akron are both encouraged by Malik becoming mayor. He ran on platforms of public safety and talking about changes to the police department. So there's hope that he could bring some real change to the city and this mistrust in police and this bad relationship that the community has with the police. But others are really skeptical. And I think that this process that he'll be going through right when he enters office to hire a new police chief will really be a test of how people view his administration and the way that he works to, I mean, as he says, fix the relationship between the police and the community. But either way, he's promised some changes to the police department in terms of community policing, changes to policy. So, you know, we'll be following that very closely to see what he does and what kind of impact that has on the community.
Definitely, certainly some changes on the way for Akron. In Cleveland, Mayor Justin Bibb says last week's shooting on Public Square that injured two people speaks to the need for parents to step up. The shooting erupted after the holiday lighting last week. Both the suspects and victims are underage. Josh, this was part of Mayor Bibb's sit-down with IdeaStream reporters yesterday when he commented on this. We're going to have continuing coverage of the Q&A session here on WKSU and online at IdeaStream.org. Josh, you've been going through the interview.
Yeah.
Just his reaction to this shooting at a really what's a prominent downtown event.
Yeah, and I think it was a little surprising, too, because he came right out and said, look, the government could not prevent what happened last weekend. You know, there was a large group of kids. They were fighting. Police went in. They did their job. They tried to get that fight to stop, but someone pulled out a gun. So the mayor says two things are at play here. The first thing, we have an illegal gun problem in the city. He says more than likely that gun that was used at Public Square was illegal. And number two, he says parents need to step in. They need to take more responsibility for their kids. They need to know where their kids are, who their kids are with, and what they are doing. And, you know, there's just not a lot of simple answers when addressing this. You know, I think a lot of people want to say we need more police. That will fix it. The problem is there's such a push to bring more people downtown right now. It couldn't have happened at a worse time.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there was legislation regarding curfew where the parents can be, you know, prosecuted, I suppose,
right,
for these curfew violations. I mean, did he suggest kind of what the next step is to find these parents, hold them accountable? Because, you know, in a way, he's right. I mean, these are teenagers in some cases. They're not yet adults. But you go along the problem of how, right? How do we address this?
Yeah, and he didn't get specific when talking about that. And I think a part of that strategy, at least politically, was take the pressure off of the administration a little bit, take the pressure off of police, because they have been working so hard since this summer going into, well, the holiday season right now to clean up the streets. Really, with illegal guns, getting illegal guns off the streets and getting felons off the streets as well. So no specific plans, but he's saying, hey, parents, we need your help in order to do this, in order to clean up Cleveland and get the violence down. You need to step up.
And certainly over the summer, we saw state intervention, federal intervention with the state highway patrol and the U.S. Marshals trying to help out with some of the crime issues because there's a police shortfall. I know at least some on council are saying, hey, this needs to continue. We need to bring the state troopers back. But speaking of the staffing issues with the police, Mayor Bibb and the police union have done a lot to, I mean, we've seen significant pay increases agreed to, higher pay for cadets, fast tracking for some of the cadets. Obviously, that's going to take some time to come to fruition, but that's kind of how he's tried to manage this police shortfall.
Yeah, and they say it's been successful, or it's starting to be successful so far. I mean, they are doing everything they can, Glenn, to recruit people, higher wages, their sign-on bonuses, their schedules. The police officers' schedules have completely changed, so they're not constantly filling in for each other. They've restructured it with the police union. Until we get to that point, and the mayor, Justin Bibb, said yesterday when he sat down with us that there is 300 openings right now in the police department. They're down 300 still. So there's a lot of work to be done, and until we get to that point, Cuyahoga County Sheriff and the Ohio State Highway Patrol will be helping.
And what can you really do about the illegal guns on the streets now other than what we talked about, which is, you know, it seems like when the State Highway Patrol is involved or when Cleveland police are able to pull some people over traffic stops, they find guns and things like that. But it just seems like it's an overwhelming problem.
Yeah, and they have been strategic about it with this RISE initiative that they started over the summer. They've put some numbers out and said, hey, look, this is what we've done. Looking at those numbers, though, it's been a challenge for us in the newsroom to say, because we haven't had that before, to say, okay, what does this really mean in the big picture? So to put that into some context. But you know, people are demanding something be done, the mayor and the police department. And it's not just the police department. The state and federal law enforcement are stepping up, too. They have gotten legal guns off the streets. Felons are off the streets. But they're claiming early success. But this initiative will have to continue. And I think last weekend was a sign of that. There's still a lot of frustration and a lot of danger, too.
Certainly when you're trying to bring more people, you know, back downtown and have these events and you have an incident like this that takes up all the headlines, that can be very difficult. Josh, thanks very much. When we come back, we'll discuss the continuing criticism directed toward Youngstown State University over its hiring of Ohio Congressman Bill Johnson as its new president. This is the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Glenn Forbes, in for Mike McIntyre. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Glenn Forbes, and for Mike McIntyre, joined this week by Josh Boos and Abigail Botar from IdeaStream Public Media and State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Youngstown State University still getting blowback after it selected U.S. Representative Bill Johnson as its new president. Johnson is currently representing Ohio's 6th district in Congress, which includes eastern and southeastern Ohio, including Mahoning County. Johnson, a close ally of former President Trump, and voted to overturn the 2020 election. Josh, some of the university's biggest donors are threatening to pull support over Johnson's hiring. We just heard recently IdeaStream Public Media's Connor Morris talked to Ed O'Neill of Married with Children fame, Modern Family fame, 4 touchdowns in 1 game at Polk High. Sorry, that's just a Married with Children reference. But to be serious, Ed O'Neill not happy about this. He's threatening to pull support.
Yeah, Connor came up to us yesterday in the newsroom and said, I just talked to Ed O'Neill. That Ed O'Neill? Yes, he played football at Youngstown. He said he got a doctorate from YSU, an honorary degree. This is Ed O'Neill. He says he's going to give it back. He doesn't want it. He's going to start calling YSU Trump U. And he says a lot of people are going to feel that way. He was really fired up. He's not the only one either. The chairman of the Youngstown State University Board of Trustees resigned. And then a major donor, Bruce Zolden, he owns Phantom Fireworks. He recently gave about $5 million to the university to fund a new student center. He's saying, okay, you got to rescind the hiring of Johnson, or I'm going to stop giving money. And I don't, by the way, I don't want my name on the new student center building. So a lot of pushback here.
Yeah, it's amazing. We were talking a little bit about this yesterday, and you pointed out to me that it's not kind of politics the way that it used to be. And you attribute it to the 2020 election. And it's like you're either one side or the other on that one. And there isn't a lot of middle ground. There is not a lot of moderation when it comes to this issue. And I think we're seeing that with this kind of groundswell or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. And Bruce Zolden even went as far as to say, look, we do not want anyone political in this role. Is everybody political? Yes. They have their own thoughts. They have their, you know, what they believe, their values. But I feel it's at a different level now because it's so amplified and it's so far away from each other, maybe the most that it's ever been. So, yeah, it's a different time, Glenn. People are not the students in particular are not putting up with it. They do. They want better.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, about the students. We've seen a lot of student demonstrations tied to Israel and Hamas and things like that. And so, you know, what has kind of their reaction been? Has there been any sort of, organized movement there, or are they just, kind of voicing their displeasure?
Voicing their displeasure, and I think, too, I mean, the big issue here is this selective hiring process. That's what they're saying. That's what a lot of the detractors are saying right now. The University Board of Trustees met recently when they made the official announcement for the new president. Students and YSU supporters, they wanted to speak. They kept saying, please let us speak before you go into executive session. We want to have our say about this. And they were turned away. They weren't allowed to speak. The board says they interviewed candidates behind closed doors. They did not want to release the names because of they didn't want to scare off any potential high quality candidates. But others are saying we haven't heard any other names that came in besides this.
Interesting, too, that when this decision proposal, I suppose, came out, that, Johnson said he was not seeking this job. This kind of came out of left field for him, to paraphrase. He was not seeking this job. Youngstown State approached him. Now, Johnson is stepping away from Congress in 2024. He also echoes some of State Senator Serino's rhetoric about a diversity of voices needed on campus. This idea that college campuses in Ohio have become too liberal. I can't remember the exact, I'm sure Karen remembers the exact term that Senator Serino used, but these liberal bastions, if you will, that's kind of the opinion. And where does Johnson come down on that? I would assume, he would agree with at least some of that opinion.
Well, very much so. And he has said previously on his Facebook page that institutions are indoctrinating students to liberal views. This is not something new, by the way. This is something that's been around for a long time, but more and more people are speaking out about it. In Senator Serino's bill, which doesn't appear to be going anywhere, it would ban staff and employees from universities from striking. It would require college students to take certain American history courses. The tenure for professors would be based around bias and all this mandatory diversity, equity, inclusion training. That would be prohibited. It goes very far, that bill. And I think that's part of the reason it's not going to, at least as of right now, doesn't look like it has any legs. So, he has supported that. On his Facebook page said, yes, liberal views are in college. These students are being indoctrinated when they go to school.
We'll have a bit more on that education overhaul bill in just a moment. But first, Ohio will receive $110 million as part of a settlement with three chemical companies over so-called forever chemicals and decades of contamination in southeast Ohio. The state sued the companies, including DuPont, over PFAS or per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. Ohio alleged in its lawsuit the companies dumped 500,000 pounds of the synthetics into the Ohio River and also released the substances into the air. Josh DeWine filed this lawsuit in 2018 when he was attorney general. So, of course, I'm sure, he's somewhat pleased with the settlement. He says it was the best outcome for the state.
Yeah, and they were asked to, both the governor and Attorney General Dave Yost were asked, wait a second, couldn't you have gotten more money from this? Why did you go ahead and settle here? And both of them, Dave Yost says, look, the payment will be made actually in a lump sum within a month. Yes, they may have been awarded more money in a jury trial, but they might not have seen that money altogether if DuPont would have filed bankruptcy protection, something like that. And that's what's happened to a lot of the opioid cases. So that is something that they say, look, we're going to get the money in a month. We're going to put it in these accounts and we're going to get right to work, where a lot of people with the opioid lawsuits are not going to see any of the money or a fraction thereof.
So this contamination, Josh, it's tied to DuPont's site along the Ohio-West Virginia border. They made their Teflon-coated products. What do we know about the health ramifications at this time?
So there's not a lot that we do know right now. At high levels, the governor says there's different types of cancers that have been linked to these forever chemicals, but we don't know the full health ramifications. Dave Yost, the attorney general, came right out and said, look, this story is not over. This settlement does not mean that we are done with this, because and this will likely play out for years to come, because so much is unknown. Will they continue to do testing? Yes. Will they continue to do monitoring of the water? Yes. But there's a lot of unanswered questions still to how this will play out.
And still somewhat unanswered, although we may have somewhat of an idea, how the money will be used in Ohio. What do we know about that?
Very clear, actually. They have a strategy where about 80% of it is going to go to Southeast Ohio, where this happened, for water filters, even a new water source if needed, and they'll do some monitoring as well. And then the rest of that will be done as part of this environmental helping in the state, testing in the state. So a big chunk of that going down, though, to where this originated in Southeast Ohio.
We're going to be hearing a lot more about PFAS. In fact, there are some other lawsuits as well. One this week was thrown out by an appeals court filed by a firefighter that could have impacted millions of Ohioans. What do we know about that?
Yeah. Well, the judges came out and said, look, we cannot connect the firefighter to the foam of the fire that he used to these PFAS. There was no connection. So if this firefighter had exposure to large amounts of these forever chemicals, as they're called, how will others link to that? I mean, the issue is, if this firefighter is having issues and is around this in large quantities, if someone who is just, not getting it as a large enough quantity, then the story's not over. But there's going to be very unlikely that they will be able to proceed in court with something like this.
And, of course, the story not over here at IdeaStream either. We're going to have a lot of reporting coming up on PFAS in 2024 and what these forever chemicals are found in and what the potential effects could be. So stay tuned here to WKSU and online IdeaStream.org. Josh, thanks very much. A preliminary report and body cam footage released this week by the Ohio State Highway Patrol gives more details on what happened in a chain reaction crash that claimed the lives of 3 Tuskegee Valley students and 3 adults last month. The students were all members of the marching band. They were traveling on a charter bus to Columbus when the crash occurred on I-70 in Licking County. The adults were traveling in an SUV behind the bus. Abigail, 5 vehicles involved, but this preliminary report indicates the truck at the back failed to slow down with traffic, and that kind of started this chain reaction to this tragic event.
Yeah, I mean, it was really awful to read about the details of this. But what we learned from the report was that the semi-truck was following a Nissan Murano too closely, which led to the 5-vehicle crash. The vehicles in front of the semi had began to slow down, and the semi crashed into the Murano, overriding it, and then crashing into the bus carrying the students, causing both vehicles to catch on fire. And then the semi hit a Toyota Highlander and then rear-ended another semi-truck.
The reason for the traffic slowdown also indicated there was another accident. We had heard that the day mm-hmm. that this happened, that there was another accident that was cleared, but it was still causing a slowdown for these drivers.
Yeah, I feel like that's like the great irony is that the cars in front of the semi had began slowing down as they were coming closer to the side of the accident, which happened like about an hour before this accident occurred, and the semi did not slow down with them.
No charges filed in connection to this crash as of yet, Abigail.
Right. Both the Ohio State Highway Patrol and the National Transportation Safety Board are continuing to investigate the accident. But yeah, there's been no charges filed yet.
And I remember hearing from Jennifer Homendy, who's the chair of the NTSB, I want to emphasize, this is the preliminary report that came out about this. The full investigation can take a year, 2 years. I mean, this is a long process for them.
Right. And I believe this was a preliminary report from the Ohio State Highway Patrol. So we will get another preliminary report from the NTSB, which is they are very, very thorough, as we know very well from East Palestine. As the NTSB continues to investigate, the chair, Jennifer Homendy, said could take more than a year. As they continue to investigate, they could issue policy recommendations as they come across them. So they won't hold on to all of the information until the final report is issued. If they come across changes that they think would increase safety, they will issue them as the investigation goes on.
And Jennifer Homendy seems a very professional, very passionate person, but she is not somebody you want to see twice in a calendar year. You know what I mean? You mentioned East Palestine, and you did such a great job reporting on that, and it's just unfortunate that we've seen her twice now, these two kind of disasters really in this calendar year.
Mm-hmm.
Abigail, thanks so much. The future of a bill to overhaul higher education in the state to counter what supporters say is liberal bias on campuses up in the air. We just heard about that a little bit in discussing Youngstown State. Senate Bill 83 has passed that chamber, but it's been stuck in the Ohio House since the summer. Kirtland Republican Jerry Serino, the main sponsor of the bill. Karen, a lot of news on this this week. Speaker Jason Stevens, also a Republican, of course, doesn't see the bill getting through the chamber this year. That came as news to Senator Serino, as you reported.
Yeah, when I spoke to Senator Serino after that, because Jason Stevens, the speaker, was asked by reporters about Senate Bill 83, which was going to have a hearing this week, and he said that there aren't the votes to pass it. Serino said that was a surprise to him because he had made some changes to the bill specifically to get it through the House, because it's passed the Senate along party lines, and now it's over in the House. And he said he's done a lot of things. For instance, he dropped the ban on faculty strikes that was in the bill, and I believe there's a change to the terms of trustees. Terms of trustees now are 9 years. The original bill took it down to 4 years. I think they settled on 6 years. But what was interesting to hear him say was that he doesn't believe the bill is dead, certainly. And if it doesn't survive this 2-year session, which ends next December, he says we could play the long game here and it could come back again. And what's interesting about that is that Senate President Matt Huffman has been a big supporter of this bill. He's going to run for the House next year. And if he and Jason Stevens are both elected, he plans, what we've heard, to challenge Jason Stevens as Speaker. So this bill on making these changes and addressing what conservatives believe is cancel culture and liberal bias on public university campuses, that idea is not going away.
And that second hearing, that did happen this week? That did go through?
Yeah, it did go forward. And, I guess the bill hasn't been killed. It's still in the pipeline, so to speak. But Stephen says the votes aren't there to put it forward on the floor. And that's going to be the question over the next couple of weeks is, are there the votes there? Is Serino right in saying that he thinks the votes are there because he's made the changes that people asked him to make? Or is Stevens right in saying that the votes are not there, so it's not going to move forward if it passes committee, it's not going to go to the floor?
And certainly, Karen, this is indicative of this GOP infighting that we've seen since Stevens was, elected speaker under certainly some controversy. This almost looks like, one of these, lightning rod type issues, I guess, within the GOP itself.
Oh, absolutely. This is a talking point. And next year being a presidential and U.S. Senate election year, as well as the entire Ohio House and half the Ohio Senate, I would expect that this is definitely not going to go away, at least as a talking point. And of course, the whole situation with Stevens, I mean, he still has a group, a large group, most of the Republicans in the House aligned behind Derek Maron, and Stevens got a smaller group of Republicans, but also got all the Democrats. That's how he became Speaker. So all of this kind of comes into play here.
Very interesting. And let's stay on education here. Ohio spending millions more than estimated for its newly expanded school voucher program. Original estimates from the Ohio Legislative Service Commission put the price tag for the EdChoice vouchers at just under $400 million this year. But based on current numbers, that cost will be closer to $412 million. And Karen, the forecast is that the demand for these vouchers is only expected to grow.
Yeah, and when I last checked in October, which was when the deadline, you had to be enrolled in a private school to apply for vouchers by October 14th, and this is the EdChoice voucher program, the expansion of it, there were about 81,000 applications that had been received, and not all of them had been processed yet. So back in October, it was estimated around, you know, the state had budgeted $240 million. The estimate was $240 million. The state had budgeted almost $400 million. And now we're finding out that, yeah, that total is a lot bigger. It's closer to $439 million. Now, once again, talking about Senate President Matt Huffman, a strong supporter of vouchers, he keeps saying that there is no worry here, that there's no problem, the state has plenty of money, and he says in the long run, it will actually cost the state less to provide vouchers for kids to go from public school to private school, or kids who were never even in public school who are going to private school. He says that'll be cheaper for the state in the long run. That's a real question. And certainly schools are saying that this is taking money away from money that they need because most kids are in public school.
Yeah, and you know, as the costs rise and the demand rises, what about the sustainability of this program? I mean, you mentioned it's a favorite of Matt Huffman and I'm sure other, you know, powerful Republican lawmakers. But, you know, have we heard anything about what they think the sustainability of this is?
Well, and that's the long-term question. I mean, yeah, the state has a lot of money right now because of a lot of different economic things that are going on. But what do you do when you're spending a $1 billion a year on these voucher programs when you still have public schools that have needs? And so that continues to be the question. And we keep being reassured by people like Senate President Huffman that the money's there, the money will be there. The long-term goal of this is to make it sustainable. But this is essentially a universal voucher program. Anybody who wants a voucher to send their kids to private school can get one. The higher the income you have, the less of a voucher you get. But this is still a program that allows pretty much anybody who wants a voucher, a state-paid assistance for private school tuition, you can get it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that there is really no income requirement. Karen, some are concerned that the expanded vouchers, they're not reaching lower income and non-white families as supporters say they would. What do we know about that?
Well, I think right now when Howard Fleeter, who is the reigning school funding expert in Ohio, looked at some of these numbers, and it really does appear that people are using vouchers who have never sent their kids to public school, because that was the initial idea, was that you take your kids out of a failing public school and you send them to private school. Now you don't even have to be sending your kids to public school to get a voucher. And the vouchers, I mean, they've also increased. They went from $5,500 for kindergarten through eighth grade to $6,165. High school students went from $7,500 to $8,400, a little over that. So the increase is getting bigger there, as well as the popularity. A lot of people are finding out that this is an option that's available to them, and they're certainly looking into it.
All right, Karen, sticking in Columbus, the Ohio House voted nearly unanimously this week on a bill that eliminates the marital exemptions for rape and sexual misconduct. House Bill 161 passed by a vote of 74-1, now heads to the Ohio Senate for consideration. A lot of attention around this bill there's some historical implications here. Ohio's one of a few states that still had this on the books. The lone holdout was State Representative Bill Dean of Xenia. Any word on why he voted against this bill?
Well, he talked to a couple of reporters. Well, he talked to a non-journalist right after this who posts a lot of stuff on social media, who chased him all the way through the state house and into the state house lawn and everything. But then he did talk to journalists from the USA Today network, the Columbus Dispatch, Cincinnati Inquirer, and other papers, and said that he did not believe that if two people are married, that a man can rape his wife. And he says it could even be used as a wedge between a husband and wife and their family. So that's a pretty extraordinary thing to say. It's gotten a lot of attention. He didn't say it publicly on the floor, which I think would have been really extraordinary if he had actually said these things in public where other people could have heard what he said. But this is a bill that's been a long time coming. I mean, this has been proposed multiple times. This is the furthest it's ever gotten. Ohio is one of 11 states that still has this so-called marital rape loophole. And so the effort to get rid of this has been a long time coming, and they got an almost unanimous vote. But there's that one out there that really, I think, shocked a lot of people.
Karen, I wanted to ask you quickly, too, about Governor DeWine and Lieutenant Governor Husted. They've received a subpoena as part of First Energy Investors' lawsuit connected to the $60 million bribery scheme that brought down former House Speaker Larry Householder. DeWine being asked to provide communication he might have had with First Energy executives and former Public Utilities Commission of Ohio Chair Sam Randazzo.
Yeah, and I think the governor's office says that this is a subpoena for documents and not really a surprise. The governor himself said that he will be complying. Lieutenant Governor John Husted will be asked to give a deposition, which is, you know, a sworn statement, a sworn interview, essentially, for in regard to this lawsuit sometime in late February, early March of next year. This is the lawsuit that investors at First Energy filed over the case. It's not a criminal lawsuit. It's a civil lawsuit. But, of course, it's connected to the criminal lawsuit, which had Larry Householder, the former Ohio House Speaker, going to prison for 20 years. That's where he is now. And former Ohio Republican Party Chair Matt Borges in prison for 5 years. So all of this has created one thing that's important to remember. A lot of the elements of House Bill 6, the law that all this is centered around, are still in place. While the bailout of the nuclear power plants did get eliminated, there are other things that are still in place with related to that law.
That story not quite over yet.
And, it's a story that just keeps on going. It really does.
And its ramifications will continue for quite a while as well. All right, Karen, thanks so much. A few more stories to get to, including Glenville's chances to build on its history-making championship. This is the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Glenn Forbes, in for Mike McIntyre. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Glenn Forbes, and for Mike McIntyre, along with Karen Kassler, Abigail Botar, and Josh Boose. Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose told a Senate candidates forum hosted by the Strongsville GOP that abortion opponent groups helped craft the ballot language for State Issue 1, which amends the state constitution to provide abortion and reproductive health protections. It passed with 57% of the vote last month. Yes, it's December 1st. The election was already last month. Karen, LaRose certainly not shy about his status as a Republican, but you know, I'm sure opponents feel like this maybe crosses a line in terms of his duties as election chief, as Secretary of State.
I don't think it was a surprise, but it is quite an admission that the person in charge of writing the summary language for the ballot board, because it's the Secretary of State's office that writes that summary language, and the ballot board, which he chairs, that passed that language, was being directed by a group that directly opposed the issue and was raising money to fight the issue. It's really quite extraordinary. Now, he was speaking before the Strongsville GOP, which is a very extreme right group. I mean, they're a very conservative organization. And so this is just one of the things he said. He also was talking in some videos that I've seen about the 2020 primary and how he personally oppose the decision to delay the primary and to allow the primary to go on longer. You might remember that that was kind of a last-minute thing, but he stood there with Governor DeWine and made the announcement that there was going to be a month, essentially, of voting remotely because you couldn't have that in-person voting because of the pandemic. But this is these are some of the issues that Strongsville GOP is very interested in. And so to hear that he had taken direction, essentially, from Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, the Center for Christian Virtue, Ohio Right to Life, these are the groups that campaigned against Issue 1, that he was kind of working with them on crafting that controversial language that resulted in a lawsuit and even was shown in the one poll to have potentially changed some minds on this issue. It's pretty amazing.
Karen, you know I love to talk politics and kind of the political angle of all this. I mean, you know, we see typically the conventional wisdom is when you're in a primary, you move further to the right. When you're in general, you move, you know, a little bit more to the middle. LaRose, of course, vying for the Republican nomination to face Sherrod Brown next fall. But he has Issue 1. He's been taking some losses lately, Karen. Let's put it that way. How is this impacting his campaign?
Well, we'd like to see his fundraising numbers, but I don't think he has filed that. I think that he's still behind on that. And he doesn't have the name recognition that he would want to have at this point, according to one poll, which is interesting because you'd think, I mean, we talk about him all the time, but of course, people who are thinking about who they're going to vote for next year for U.S. Senate in the primary, they're not even thinking about that. They're thinking about Christmas. They're thinking about other things, you know? So I think that these are the kinds of things that could potentially hurt him in some ways, but these are also the kind of things that voters who were against Issue 1, who for whom abortion is a main driver in their vote, they may be very supportive of him because they see him as a fighter on their side. So I think it remains to be seen what's going to happen here. But I do know that Bernie Marino, as he's one of the other two, Bernie Marino and Matt Dolan, Bernie Marino has been on the air with ads.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So it's only going to ramp up from here.
I was just going to ask, I don't know what's been on your TVs, but several times I have seen that commercial where Donald Trump says, we love Ohio. We love Bernie Marino. And I mean, that is repeated throughout the commercial. And Bernie is not being shy about that. And as you mentioned, Karen, he's already out there on the air quite a bit.
Yeah, and nobody's gotten that coveted Trump endorsement. And today, my State House News Bureau colleague Joe Engels is with the State Central Committee, the Republican State Central Committee, which is going to consider a presidential endorsement for next year, but not a U.S. Senate endorsement. These endorsements, that Trump endorsement is the real trophy here to try to win the March primary. It's seen as once you get that, you've kind of won.
All right, Karen, thanks very much. Want to switch gears very quickly. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway claims in a lawsuit that the Haslam family, owners of the Cleveland Browns, attempted to bribe executives at the Pilot truck stop chain. The goal of the suit claims was to inflate the value of the remaining 20% stake in the chain that Berkshire will acquire in 2024. The counter lawsuit, the latest jab between billionaires. We love watching billionaires fight, don't we? The Haslams accused Berkshire Hathaway of trying to undervalue the company. Josh, this is the acquisition of Pilot by Berkshire has been going on since 2017. This 20% stake, part of the final part of this deal.
Yeah, no losers here, Glenn. They're, you know, both billionaires. But you know, this counter lawsuit here says that the Haslams really tried to undervalue their company and were bribing people, bribing their own workers to undervalue it so that Berkshire wouldn't have to pay as much. And so the big question, and now Berkshire says, wait a second, we pay too much for that. We want to see some validation for what happened. So it's going to play out in the courts as we head into the new year.
And of course, there was the scandal involving Pilot Flying J, and the truckers previously. So we'll certainly keep an eye on that as well. Wanted to end things a little lighter. State high school football playoffs underway at Tom Benson Stadium in Canton. The stadium is part of the Pro Football Hall of Fame and Village. Playoffs began last night with the Division II Finals. Maslin defeated Akron Hoban 7-2, a big win for the Tigers, their first in the playoff era, and maybe those footballs that they give out in the cribs of the hospital will have, like, the state champion emblem on them. So, big deal down there. And Akron Hoban, certainly congratulations to them as well. They've had a fantastic run the last couple years. The matchup that will have most of Cleveland watching, Division IV final Saturday night between Glenville and Kettering. Glenville seeking to build on last year's historic win with a defense of its title. They're the first Cleveland school to win a state championship. The Tar Blooders, led by legendary coach Ted Ginn Sr. Good luck to all the other Northeast Ohio teams playing in the finals. St. Ed's, of course, again, Perry, Kirtland, and Doughton. To get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter @TheSoundOfIdeas. Coming up Monday on The Sound of Ideas, how do you feel about tipping? New technology has made tipping more prevalent than ever. They even give you the little percentage on there quite often, leading to confusion and even complaints, especially on social media. We'll discuss tipping with experts. We encourage you to weigh in via email or by calling the show. Now, if you missed any portion of the program, you can find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. Check out the television version, Ideas, tonight at 7:30 on WVIZ PBS. I'd like to thank Josh Boos, associate producer here at IdeaStream Public Media, Abigail Botar, our fine reporter here at IdeaStream Public Media, and, of course, State House Bureau Chief Karen Kessler. Thank you all for joining us here on The Sound of Ideas. Now, as we do every Friday, we leave you with a song. This is the Irish band The Pogues and Love You Till the End. The band's lead singer, Shane McGowan, died yesterday at the age of 65. I'm Glenn Forbes, in for Mike McIntyre. Thanks so much for listening.